What is a man? Today on It's So Bad, we're going to find out what a man really is as we play Castlevania Symphony of the Night on the podcast. Welcome, Chris.
Why, hello. Great, great detailed intro.
Steve.
Michael. Yeah, I second that. Very detailed intro.
So we are adding Castlevania Symphony of the Night, our second Castlevania game, to the Endless List, which is a list that goes from number one Super Mario 64 all the way down to number 95, which is Jurassic Park Trespasser. Last week we added The Last of Us at number 17 to the list. Our list is a list of the best games, the worst games, every game in between. We are playing every video game and adding it to this list week by week. And this is the podcast. Welcome to newcomers who are joining us for the first time, and every week for the next, this week. So this week and the next 4 weeks, we'll be adding four or five of what we consider to be the best games of all time, as chosen by our co-hosts. Last week was our first episode doing that, which was The Last of Us. And this week we're adding a Symphony of the Night, the October 1997 release from Konami Computer Entertainment Tokyo, published by Konami, directed by Toru Hagihara and Koji Igarashi. And I believe, was this Steve's, was this your selection?
This was, yeah, this was my pick.
Why did you pick this one specifically?
So I know this is a game that's been on, you know, the best of the best lists for a long time, and I knew about it. I'd never played a Castlevania game before, but I've over the last, you know, three, 4 or 5 years, started getting more into Metroidvania games. So I knew this was like one of the founding games for the Metroidvania genre. Similarly, I picked that we do Super Metroid around this time last year. So, you know, I'm working my way through the foundational games, but really, really love like the exploration and combat of Metroidvania. So I figured I'd go to what I had heard is considered like the best Metroidvania game, basically. And especially like over the Super Metroid side of it, like Castlevania really being like a really varied, fleshed out, like kind of ahead of its time game.
This is the Vania.
This was your first Castlevania game ever, playing it for this?
First one ever, yep. I never played one before. I have, really? I've watched the Netflix show, but that's kind of like Castlevania exposure before this.
It's so exciting watching someone venture into this new territory.
I know. Well, I'm familiar with like the genre. Like I've played like Ori and the Blind Forest and Hollow Knight and Super Metroid. So like, you know, I really like
Castlevania's got its own like very convoluted, not convoluted, I guess, but very deep.
No, you're right. No, it's super convoluted
that you can now explore through many other.
Yeah. And I've like growing up, like I've always like been into like, you know, I liked like different vampire fiction and stuff and like gothic horror. So like this just felt like right up my alley too. So I'm very interested in playing this game for the pod.
Yeah. So this is this game came out at a really interesting time. This was the transition from 2D to 3D. So in 1996, you had the big release was Super Mario 64. But also in 1996, you had Resident Evil, Quake came out, Crash Bandicoot. But just to like the tension between 2D and 3D, no one wanted to make 2D games anymore. Everybody was like, 3D is the best, new, biggest thing. So this game came out at a point where people were like, huh, you're making a 2D game? Really? Why not make it in 3D? But I mean, even in 1996, you had games like Donkey Kong Country 3 came out, Super Mario RPG came out. But yeah, so there was a ton of like, This game was backwards because it didn't really match the time period. But this was basically
Was Castlevania 64 already out?
I don't believe so. I think that came out in 98 or 99.
Once that comes out, then you go, oh yeah, maybe we should stick to making 2D games.
Yeah. This game feels like the like ultra Super Nintendo game, basically, right? It's like everything that you wanted to do with the Super Nintendo but couldn't do, you did it on, this is the game that does it. It just feels like the height of that era.
Right, and isn't the reason that this is like a PlayStation game in the 3D game era too? Like that it had like a long development cycle too, right? They had started making it earlier, like for Sega. Sega CD ended up being too crazy, so they went to PlayStation instead.
I didn't realize this was actually not a Sega CD game. It was developed as a 32X game.
Oh, that's what it is.
Yep. Originally, it was supposed to be called The Bloodletting, Castlevania The Bloodletting, to be like tie into the Genesis game Bloodlines.
Right.
But it moved to PlayStation because the 32X failed because it was a terrible idea. It was basically like it was supposed to be like a bridge to the next generation, but also keep up the 16-bit generation at the same time. It was just a bad idea. So 32X failed. It moved to PlayStation.
Right. Which is incidentally kind of like what this game does. Like it's kind of like, you know, the best version of like what you said of like a Super Nintendo side scroller, but in the PlayStation era. It's like kind of, and we talked about this on the pod before too, but like those early 3D games in like the PlayStation 1 era, like don't, at least from a graphical perspective, don't hold up as well. And I guess like as a result, the gameplay, the mechanics, like they don't hold up as well when you revisit them, like those early 3D games.
Right.
Whereas like these 2D style games, and especially one made like well over the hump of like, you know, Super Nintendo, you know, this is like a few years after that, just like being able to nail that 2D style and artwork and gameplay so well. In a way that, like, when you go back to early 3D games, it's like, this is a piece of garbage. Like, this doesn't work well at all.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it still feels like a great game. So Koji Igarashi. So I should mention too, before we get into some of the history behind it, this game came out on Saturn. I don't know if you guys know this. So, it was released on the Saturn, but it's only a Japanese release, and it's supposedly like very similar. I don't know why they never brought it to the U.S. Saturn, but it was a PlayStation 1 and a Saturn game. Eventually, and it has a weird release history. Like, they keep it close to their vest. They don't, like, put it on everything. I don't know if that's to dilute its not to dilute its value or if they have exclusive deals with people. But it was only put out on the Xbox 360. Then it was put out on the PSP. And then, most recently, it's been put out on PS4 as well in the Requiem collection, which was that in Rondo of Blood.
Well, and also on the mobile too.
Yeah, I was gonna say it's on iOS now.
Android and iOS now too, yeah. I have no clue how you input those commands to do like special moves on iOS or Android. That sounds miserable.
Well, I think it coincided with the update to iPhones that let you use Xbox and PS4 controllers as Bluetooth controllers. So
got it. Yeah, so Koji Igarashi, he is the kind of the person that drove this. The other gentleman, Toru Hagihara, he kind of like got promoted in the middle of the development of this, and Koji Igarashi took over the design of this game midstream. So he's kind of the guy that tied his boat to this. You might know this person as the dude who dresses up in goth clothing to promote Bloodstained Ritual of the Night. Because he's the Bloodstained Ritual of the Night guy. He's the guy behind that as well. And Bloodstained Curse of the Moon and all that.
Right. That's like the spiritual successor to this, right?
Right.
The Castlevania franchise.
Yes. He usually appears in videos in like full-on goth outfit with like a cowboy hat and a red goblet of red wine.
I mean, that makes perfect sense based on some of the like item and equipment combinations you can get in this game that are just like completely off the wall and weird and like gothic but modern and crazy.
Yeah, he previously worked on Gradius 2. He worked on Twin B, which are both two shooter games, and then they put him on Rondo of Blood, which is where he kind of took over the Castlevania franchise. Rondo of Blood, by the way, is an excellent game that we should eventually add to this list. It's more of like a traditional Castlevania game, but it is extremely hard, but it is also very good.
I'm down. I'm ready to play. I mean, we're putting all the games on the list. So.
Yeah, right. Chris, have you played Rondo of Blood?
Yes. I've played a vast majority of the Castlevania games.
I've played and beaten Dracula X, which was the Super Nintendo version of that game that is just like not nearly as good. But Rondo of Blood might be the best game that was originally released in Japan and didn't come out in the United States for a very long time. It might be the best import exclusive video game. But yeah, so he worked on Rondo of Blood. Then he was like, how can we change this formula up a bit and make it so that a couple things. So he thought that like Rondo of Blood and other previous Castlevania games were short and he wanted people to be able to play them for a longer period of time. He also thought that they were really hard and he wanted to make them so that people, anyone could eventually play it. And that's why they added the RPG system. That's why they added the nonlinear gameplay and all of that stuff in there. So this game, so a lot of people tend to think that this game is inspired by Super Metroid and Metroid. Koji Igarashi has said that this game is actually inspired by The Legend of Zelda and previous Castlevania games. The original Legend of Zelda, in terms of using items to open up paths and things like that. And within Castlevania, the series, there's Simon's Quest, which is similar to this in some ways, but extremely cryptic, which is a nonlinear gameplay. You can go left or right. You can go to different castles. Items open up pathways and things like that. But it is extremely cryptic, especially the U.S. version. And the Japanese version, the translation was bad. The localization when it came to the United States was bad. So that game just doesn't make a lot of sense unless you have a strategy guide. Chris, have you beaten Simon's Quest?
No, that's not a very fun Castlevania game.
No. It's a lot of grinding. You have to grind for items in that game.
I have it. I've never played more than like, I don't know, 20 minutes of it.
There's also a there's a Castlevania game that they made for the MSX, which was a Japanese computer it's a Microsoft compatible computer called Vampire Killer that also has a nonlinear gameplay.
Wasn't that the first game technically in the I don't know what to call it, the franchise, but didn't Vampire Killer predate the original Castlevania?
It either predates it by like a couple months or it was after it. Because it was developed, I think, around the same time. Also uses a lot of the same like style and animation. It's just because of the way the computer worked, there wasn't scrolling, so they had to change the design, which made it like a single screen, and you had to figure out how to get out of the screen,
right?
And then go to the next.
Yeah, I think Vampire Killer came first, and then I think, but whatever, they were right around each other,
right? So. Yeah, so there's an RPG progression system in this. There's a lot of RPG elements. There are weapons, many different weapons. There's many different stats that go alongside of it. So you have like an RPG build, essentially, that goes along with it, which they added in there. And I think it's a very Japanese thing to do because Japanese game design thing to do because of like games like Dragon Quest. Dragon Quest was a huge hit in Japan simply because it was a game that anybody could eventually beat. And that's why RPGs were so successful over there. Like, salarymen could pick up the game, play it for a few hours, level up, and eventually grind out winning it. And they enjoy that type of stuff. It's the limitation of you don't have to be technically proficient in a game. You can just eventually get your stats up high enough to beat a game.
Right, it's like the little like nostalgia rush, or not nostalgia, dopamine hit that you get when you're like, oh, now I have this item, and I'm like, my stats go up here, and now I have this ability, and I can like get to this area, and you just like become gradually more and more powerful, and like kind of customize your character the way you want to too. Like there's different, like you said, there's different weapons you can have, different throwable items. You can change your cape that gives you different abilities. You are the son of Dracula, so you can take different forms like wolf and mist and bat. And you just become like, it's a power trip. You become like this ultimate badass vampire character.
Yeah. And they do the whole thing of you getting all your power stripped away at the beginning of the game. I forget what that's called. It's like item tease or something like that.
Oh yeah. You fight death and he's like, no, you're coming into Dracula's castle. You got to start at tier zero.
Right. This game, does a great job of incorporating the lore of the series. So, for the time period, games did not reference previous games typically. So if you like played like Link to the Past, the Zelda game, it's not referencing Zelda or Zelda 2. If you play Mario games, they're not referencing previous Mario games. But this game starts at the very end of Rondo of Blood. It starts at the boss battle, the final boss battle from Rondo of Blood, and you then take over as Alucard after that battle. And then they referenced the series throughout the entire game, which I thought was a really nice touch to incorporate all of that different lore. At one point, you fight all the three main characters from Castlevania 3 as a boss fight.
Oh, right. Yeah, you fight. Wait, who are the three characters? That's
in the Colosseum, in the Upside Down Castle, you fight Sypha and Grant and Trevor Belmont.
Right, yeah. Yeah, and like you said, it picks up where the last game starts, or picks up where the last game ends, and then you're Alucard, and you come into the castle, and it seems like, you know, this is the only game I've played, but from, like, what I've read up on the series, like, it tries to, like, invert a lot of the Castlevania tropes. Like, you play as Richter to begin with, and he's the hero, and then he kind of becomes, like, the cryptic villain, because the story is that, like, he's defeated Dracula, but the castle's still there, and it's 4 years later, and Alucard, who is Dracula's, like, half-vampire, half-human son, shows up, and he's just trying to investigate the castle and the disappearance of Richter and, like, what's happened, and there's always the sneaking suspicion that Dracula is going to come back, and that's how you get in here. But you're not actually, for the beginning of the game, like, hunting Dracula. You're hunting Richter, basically.
Right. So the really confusing thing about this series, but I think they kind of show you what's happening more in the anime, and since you've watched the anime, you'll know this. Dracula's castle tends to just disappear sometimes, and then it reappears for some reason.
Yeah. That's because Dracula is, like, this ancient being who has studied, like, alchemy and science and magic, and like his castle is like this clockwork living, like, eerie vampire castle that can travel.
Yeah, so when you start the game after he defeated Dracula, the castle disappeared and then it reappeared, so he's going to investigate why it reappeared, and then he finds out that Richter's there, and he's like, I'm the new master of the castle, I'm here to take over. But yeah, even like there's again more touches, like when you first enter the castle, the music and the first portion of it is directly ripped from the first Castlevania game. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's a lot of little homages for people who have invested time in the series that pay off. Most of the boss fights are bosses from previous games as well. And they tend to be across all of the games, but they're just like these more epic and grand versions of what those previous bosses had been. But we talked a little bit about what makes this game good. So one of the things that when you first turn on this game and you start walking around, that's like pretty, feels really good, is the movement in this game. And the animation of the movement is like bar none, like really good, even to this day. It feels so good. The smoothness of his walking and the jumping and just in every aspect of the combat just feels very good.
Yeah, he kind of floats as he moves. Like he's just like, he's a vampire. So he's like kind of like quickly moving, and he has this like kind of shadow phase like effect as he moves through the air to like signify that he's supernatural, and when you jump it follows you around, so it's kind of like you're like, you can just see how agile he is as a vampire, and the controls reflect that too, because it's pretty responsive, so you can platform and bounce around and swing and fight enemies up high and up low like very, very easily. It's very intuitive.
When you first enter the castle, too, it's a non-linear game in that you're going to go back to the same spots over and over again, but the progression pretty much shows you where you need to go in terms of from a map design standpoint. There's like a logical place where you should be checking out. I should also say, too, that this game, in comparison to Super Metroid, has a better map system in terms of like marking where things are on the map and letting you know where you can go to like save points and where you can go to warps and where you haven't gone yet, where what needs to be explored, where there's dead ends, things like that. So this game kind of innovated on the genre in a couple different ways compared to Super Metroid, making the map a little bit better and also adding in the RPG elements and the item weapon management, equipment management stuff that that game just didn't have.
Yeah, we talked about that on the Super Metroid pod, where there were like areas that you thought were connected that you can go from one area to another, but there's actually a wall in between, and that's not very clearly marked on the map, so you could like spend a lot of time poking around in the corners of the map, which you're supposed to do in a Metroid game, but right. like end up like, oh, there's nothing here. I just like, I thought that there might be, the map kind of tricked me into thinking I could get from A to B, but there's no connection there. Where in Symphony of the Night, like, it's true. They show you, it's like, oh no, you can't go any farther here. You don't have to waste your time poking around. But if there's not like that barrier there, you can be like, all right, there's some sort of secret that I need to find in this area. And it just makes the whole gameplay and exploration feel better.
Yeah, I mean, so Chris, what do you, where, for you, what's your experience with this game?
I played it years ago. I never owned it, but I think, I'm trying to remember, I don't know if I rented it or if it was like I had friends that had it and played it. So this was like my first time playing it, for the most part, all the way through. Actually, I didn't have a chance to beat it before this episode, but... I had played it years ago, but I think by that point I was already playing the DS series of, the GBA and DS, yeah. series of games. So, you know, I think in my mind at the time I was like, well, I want to go back and play an older one. I want to keep playing, like, I think Portrait of Ruin was like the one I was probably just playing at the time. And I was like, you know, I'm going to stick with this and not go backwards. But I mean, going back and playing it for this podcast, it really was like kind of like what you guys have kind of touched on. It's you know, it's one of the tightest, best controlling platformers like you would play, you know, probably more so than actually it than the Castlevanias that came after it. And you know, getting like the superpowers and the upgrades and this, I think because you are playing as Alucard, like that kind of opens up a whole new world of the types of power-ups and superpowers you can have. And really just like, I think one of the coolest parts with this game is just like how, you know, unique looking the, or how well done the enemies are, and especially the bosses, and like how gruesome some of the bosses can be. Like, you know, Steve touched on like being a fan of like, kind of growing up and kind of liking like gothic horror. Like if you were someone who like enjoys like the Hammer films from like the 60s and 70s, like this is kind of like the game that's like right up your alley in a way.
Yeah.
If you're familiar with like the Dracula or
the Frankenstein's monster
Hammer films. Yeah.
Yeah. So like the Mummy. Although, yeah.
There's no Christopher Lee or Peter Cushing to be found though. In this game, unfortunately.
There's some really cool bosses. There's some really like wild boss designs too. Grand Falloon, which is just the pile of bodies. That was the best boss. That's just so good.
And then like they fall off as like you hit them.
Yeah, and then they like chase after you, and you slowly make the ball of writhing mass of bodies.
There's another one like that. That's like a rotting corpse that has like the bugs flying around it, and you have to get through the bug shield to like hack off parts of this giant like hanging corpse.
Beelzebub. It was Beelzebub. Is that boss?
Oh yeah, that's what it is. Yep.
Yeah, there's some some other impressive ones. Dracula is very impressive at the end of the game. Gallimoth. Did you guys fight Gallimoth?
Yep. Gallimoth looks like he's from Stargate.
Yeah, he does a little bit. Yeah. There's a bunch of impressive bosses in this game that are like just eye catching. But in terms of like other things that this game has, what did you guys use for your primary weapons? Do you guys remember what you guys were using at the end of the game?
Yeah, I think I used, I got a lot of Alucard's gear. So like I was using his specific sword and his cape and his body armor if I wasn't using another one. I didn't use the shield that much as like the secondhand weapon. I used it a couple of times, but I just thought it was easier to just kind of dodge and evade than to try to like shield myself. So I tried to use like throwables or like items that would like, you know, a bomb or like a potion that would explode and like have some effect on enemies in the area.
Interesting.
That's
kind of the same approach I took too.
So there's like a ton of different, another cool thing about this game and like previous games do not do this is like Castlevania is known for the whip, right? And then this game, they're like, well, you could use a whip, but you could also use a sword or a rod or this thing that swipes four times in front of you or a punch or a shield. There's like a million different ways you could play this game eventually.
Yeah, there's different move sets you can do, like, you know, combos for Alucard's special moves where he'll like shoot out fireballs or like disappear and appear behind somebody.
It's pretty wild. Like he's Dracula, right? He's Dracula's son, so he has all his powers, and he legitimately has the powers from previous games that Dracula had. So like the shooting three fireballs out was like a staple from all of the different games. So it's pretty wild. You eventually learn pretty much everything. One of the things, so when I originally played this game, I think I just had like a standard like powerful sword that I used to in the end game. But this time I went out of my way to find the like OP combo when I was playing through it, because I was like, I just wanted to have that experience. So if you combine the shield rod and the Alucard shield, and you cast the spell that the shield rod has, so some of the items have spells themselves, you hold out the shield, and every multiple times in a second, whenever something comes in contact with the shield, it deals 255 damage. It also heals you, makes you invulnerable, and gives you hearts.
Yeah, that is one of the cool parts of this game, and I didn't you can go break too deep into that.
You can break the shit out of this game.
You can do all these crazy effect combinations where, like, early on in the game I wasn't doing it, and I'd face some enemy, and I'd be like, oh man, this guy's kicking my ass, like, what do I need to do? And I'd be like, oh, I need to put on, like, the holy mail to resist his holy attacks, and if I use this special, like, rod, then I can do, like, 3x damage against him, but it's useless against all other creatures that I come across.
Right.
Like, there's a lot of that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different combinations you can make to make your experience of playing this game a lot easier. And, you know, a lot of it's just trial and error. And a lot of it at this point, at that back in the day, it was a lot of it was trial and error. But at this point, it's just Googling around what you can do. I'd known about that combination for a while now, and it's pretty fucking ridiculous. So you can, when I used that, because I wanted to get through this game because we were playing all these games for this list, fighting Gallimoth took literally less than 10 seconds. And fighting Dracula was like, you just hold out the shield and he's like instantly dead.
This is definitely one of those games too, like where you watch people speed run this game, and you see like how like, most every boss can be like exploited in some way where you can beat them fairly quickly. And I think that's actually kind of like a cool thing about the game. Like it's
There's actually a more powerful weapon in the game, but it's an extremely rare drop. It's called the Chrysogrim, which is, I don't know if you guys found the Vorpal Blade, but what it does is when you attack, it has like three strikes that come out in front of you. But the Vorpal Blade, it swings and it's so powerful, it just kills everybody like instantly. Mm. But it's an extremely rare drop in the library.
Oh no, I didn't find that. There were videos that I was watching in this game where I saw some guy playing, and whoever it was, and they would have some combination of like, you get like familiars too, or like demons that'll follow you around. One was like the flying sword, which Alucard has in the show too. So I was like looking around for that everywhere, because it's like that's such
Did
a
you
cool
find
effect.
It?
No,
Did
I couldn't find it. Couldn't find it.
I didn't find it in my first run. I found it in this run, and it's OP as hell. It's pretty cool. It talks to you, too.
Right, yeah, and that's such a cool thing from the show, is that he just has this sword that like is like kind of enchanted and flies around on its own, and he doesn't even have to swing a sword.
Yeah. There's cool things, too, with those familiars. I don't know if you found this, but there's a button that's in like the background of one of the, in like the cave, and if you have the demon, or I think the fairy, I think it's either one of those, he'll like float up there and just press the button, and it opens a pathway.
Oh, nice. No, I didn't know that.
So there's a ton of like hidden shit like that, that if you play this long enough, or if you dick around with it, you're just gonna run across it.
And that gets to like the core of the gameplay too, is that like you're in this castle and there's just so many different rooms and areas to poke around in, and you get so many different abilities that as you progress they unlock some area that you saw, and this is a staple of the Metroidvania genre, like you saw this area 100 times in the early part of the game and you could never go there, and then you get some like ability and you're like, oh, now I can go there, and it opens up like a whole section of the castle you had no idea about, and then you can now you're going to spend like 3 hours poking around this area, and like, oh, it connects to over here, and there's like an elevator now, and oh, there's this optional boss fight that I found, and I got all these like cool upgrades that maybe don't, you know, aren't special to beating the game, but now I can change my playstyle a little bit. And like Dracula's castle is such a cool environment to be doing that around, like to just kind of like poking around and finding all these like cool little hidden secrets.
Oh, and I mean there's the art design in this game is just so good that it makes going finding a new area be, you're like, whoa, this is a whole new area, this looks so cool. And that goes into a good point about this game. So you have Dracula's castle, you play through it, you get to the end, and if you don't know what you're doing and you end up fighting Richter, you're just like, the game's over, and then that's and you fight Richter, and they're like, oh, that there's no ending, it's just unsatisfying. But you, there is a optional or an additional area, which is the inverted castle, which you need to find the special glasses that allow you to see. I think they're called like just the magic glasses that allow you to see an orb above Richter's head, and then you can break the spell that's controlling him. His Dracula's servant called Shaft is controlling Richter. Which Maria, who is also venturing into this castle, she was a playable character in Rondo of Blood. She informs you that there's something wrong with Richter and you need to figure it out. And then you eventually figure it out and you break the spell and you have to go into the inverted castle, which is the same map, just upside down. And it's crazy that they were able to do that. Like, the exact same map, they made it so that it could be played right side up and upside down twice through. And it was super interesting.
I don't know if this is in every port of the game. I mean, so I played this on the PlayStation 4, but I did also download the iOS port where you can play as Richter or Maria as well. Like, you just got to enter their names as, like, your character name, and it basically unlocks a Richter game and a Maria game. Could you guys do that in the version that you played? I don't know if that's in every version.
I think you can only do that if you beat the game on the PS1 version. And also, oh, okay. I don't think Maria's in the PlayStation 1 version. I think it's just okay. Richter.
Yeah, I played this on 360, but I didn't know about that, so I didn't try it.
The iOS ports is like right from the beginning. It's like, if you want to play as Richter or Maria, put in their names as your name.
Yeah, I think Maria was exclusive to the Saturn version, actually, initially. Mm. Which is interesting. She, in Rondo of Blood, fights with a dove. She, like, instead of a whip, she sends out a dove, and it, like, acts as like a whip. It's interesting. But she's a little girl in that game, and since this is 4 years later, she becomes a woman in the time period, in the interim.
But the inverted castle is pretty cool, because like so much of the early game is like, oh, I don't have this moveset or this item, so I can't go here. And now suddenly you can pretty much go everywhere in the castle. You have all of his abilities. You can fly as a bat. So once you can fly as a bat, yeah, you can go everywhere.
You start off with like no double jump. You get a double jump, and then you're like, eventually you get like you're a bat form where you're fucking flying everywhere as well. It's
pretty much a used bat form or like fast travel to traverse most of the castle the second half of the game.
Yeah.
And then you can use like the, did you use the, like super fast bat speed to like go through areas?
No, I couldn't find that. And at that point I was so late in the game that I was just like, I figured out that was a thing. I was like, meh, whatever. I haven't been using it up to this point. I don't care about it now.
So what else do we have to say about this game? So we mentioned some of the weapons. There's some like funny things within the armor and the weapons as well. So I don't know if you found, there's Joseph's cloak, which is a nod to Joseph's Technicolor Dream Cloak. Which is, you can select the color of the cloak. It's the second best cloak in the game, which you can buy from the librarian. There's sunglasses that you pointed this out that in the description say cool looking glasses, and they give you +1 defense and -1 intelligence.
Yeah, I like that the cool glasses make you dumber.
There's a sunstone and a moonstone that, depending upon when you're playing this game, based upon the clock in your PS1 or your PS4 or whatever you're playing this on, it will increase your stats. So if you have the sunstone equipped and you're playing during the day, it'll increase your stats more than it will at night.
Oh, I didn't realize that. That's sweet.
Yeah.
There's much of that type of stuff in this game.
So much. There's so much depth of like items and weapons and techniques that you can acquire and you might not acquire in one playthrough and you might acquire in another playthrough, or even the familiars that you sometimes get and you sometimes won't get, that it's like, you like my second playthrough of this, I was like, wow, there's things that I completely missed that I got this playthrough.
Yeah, I feel like it's a little bit of a plus and a minus, because like it's so cool how much variety and like options that you have at your disposal to play this game, but at the same time, like if you don't know about them, because a lot of them are hidden, it can feel like very extraneous. It's like, why do I need to do any of this stuff? Like, I have all these menus I need to navigate through, and I felt this way sometimes, and I'm not going to use 80% of this stuff. Like, well, it's just kind of clutter. But then at the same time, like I could play this game again in like 2 years and like play an entirely different style of game, and it gives you that option.
I'll say this. So we talked about a lot of stuff on the edges, but the progression in this game is also very good. I never felt like I needed to grind or I needed to like level up that much to take on a boss or get past a certain area. It's just mainly like just getting a little bit better or understanding which weapons and items to equip to get through whatever part you need to get through.
Yeah, the only time that was a problem for me, and it was my own fault, was when I first had the inverted castle. I started venturing beyond like the initial area of the inverted castle, and I hit this huge difficulty spike. And I was like played for like an hour, and I was like, man, why can't I get through this? Like, I need to go grind some bad guys. And I realized I'd missed a room that was like full of upgrades that leveled me up. And I was like, well, okay, I feel like an idiot now. And it's kind of the same experience I have when I play these games, when I'm looking for the save spot and I'm like cautiously choosing which direction to go. And I'm like, I think the save spot's this way. And I like picked the wrong way and hit something right. And die. And it was like, if I had just gone left, the room's right there.
Right.
Like, that's how the exploration can kind of get you in these games.
Yeah, like, were you the one that, in our group chat, was the one that didn't realize that Alucard was just Dracula spelled backwards?
Oh, no. I've known that for
that
a while.
Me. That was me. That was another moment where I was like, ah, yeah. Oh, and the castle's upside down. I see what they're doing here.
Alucard was originally an alias used by Dracula I think it was 1943, Son of Dracula. So one of the early Universal Dracula movies was the first usage of Alucard.
Alucard just sounds like one of those aristocratic European names that I assumed was out there.
I think there was another movie where another alias he used was Dr. Acula, which then became kind of more well known.
That code I could have cracked.
Yes.
he was in Steve. He was a playable character in Castlevania 3 as well. So he wasn't just... And Castlevania 3 is what the anime series started at on, because right. Sypha is a playable character in Castlevania 3 as well.
Yeah, because it's Alucard, Sypha, and Trevor in the show.
Right. So, this is quite a game. I think it's a huge game. It is a great game. It is still holds up, like bar none. I would say this about it in terms of its influence. And comparing it to modern games, there are so many Metroidvania games that are just directly doing exactly what this game does. And a lot of them are doing it not as well. And they're still really good games. So I just went through and I was like, how many Metroidvania games, or what are the Metroidvania games that were influenced by this game? And what indie games are out there that are coming out today that are influenced? And I'm just going to run through some of these for you. The Ori series, Axiom Verge, Hollow Knight, Dead Cells, Salt and Sanctuary, Guacamelee, Shadow Complex, Cave Story, Rogue Legacy, Steam World Dig, Iconoclast, Time Spinner, Chasm, Blasphemous, La Mulana, Carrion, Owlboy, God of Roboto, Sundered, Dandara, Toho Luna Knights, Risk of Rain, Momodora, Apotheon. And that's like just me Googling for 5 minutes about not to mention like the countless number of Metroidvania games that are probably on Steam or Switch or anything else.
Yeah, it's got quite a legacy.
It's wild. And I mean, even within the Castlevania series, after this game, there were 6 games that completely aped the formula. So there was Castlevania Circle of the Moon. There was, what else we got? Chris, help me out.
Portrait of Ruins, Circle of the Moon.
Harmony of Dissonance, Aria of Sorrow, yeah. Dawn of Sorrow, Portrait of Ruin, Order of Ecclesia. So, like, direct rips on the entire formula.
But all those game is very good games for the most part.
Circle of the Moon's pretty good. Not as good as Symphony of the Night to me. I've played Circle of the Moon, which I greatly enjoyed. I started Dawn of Sorrow, and I could not play that game. It was just...
I didn't play Dawn of Sorrow. I liked Aria of Sorrow and Portrait of Ruin are 2 games I liked a lot.
Yeah.
And Steve, I would recommend if you liked this game quite a bit, which sounds like you did, probably moving on to some of those GBA/DS games.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're definitely on my radar now, for sure. And like I said, like I've just been very interested in all of the Metroidvania games that a lot of the ones that we just listed there. So I'm always looking for a new one.
So beyond that too, Koji Igarashi, as we mentioned, went on to make Bloodstained: Ritual of the Night, which I think I'm the only one on here who played that game. Right? Did anybody else play Ritual of the Night?
I just did the Curse of the Moon games.
Curse of the Moon was really good, which was like a incentive for that Kickstarter that they got. And it actually, I think, is probably a better game. Ritual of the Night is just, like, it's Symphony of the Night in that it's got so much to do. There's even, like, recipes to make things, which is a big part of it. Like, you have to grow rice and wheat and bread in order to make recipes, and that can help you level up. But it doesn't do it as well as Symphony of the Night does, and personally, I don't like the art style nearly as much. So that game was a pretty average game.
I've heard so much mixed like commentary about that game, where some people love it and think it's like one of the best games of, was it last year or 2 years ago that it came out?
Yeah.
And then other, like, you know, way more critical, like, this is a mess, and like, I don't even know what to make of it. Like, there's just too much slapped together in this to call it a real game. So I don't know. I've been intrigued by it, but I don't know if I should actually play it.
The one cool thing is they fast forward 30 seconds if you don't want a spoiler for this game. But it's not really that deep of a spoiler. One of the powers that they give you is invert, and it just inverts whatever room you're in. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Oh, interesting. That is cool.
Yeah. As opposed to like doing the inverted castle, you just get a power. So I thought that was pretty fun. But yeah, other than that, it wasn't super great experience. I like the Curse of the Moon game, the first one at least, better. One thing I should note too, interesting factoid about this game, Michiru Yamane, the composer, she worked on Bloodlines, Sparkster, Rocket Knight Adventures. She did the music for this game, which is like, the music in this game is also great. But she also did the music for Suikoden 3, Harmony of Dissonance, Aria of Sorrow, Dawn of Sorrow, Curse of Darkness, Lament of Innocence, Curse of Portrait of Ruin, and Order of Ecclesia, as well as Skullgirls, Bloodstained, Curse of the Moon, and Ritual of the Night. This composer, she just does a lot of work with Koji Igarashi, essentially.
Well, that Curse of the Moon soundtrack is so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Ritual of the Night also had a really good soundtrack, but that game, again, it's just... Even, like, menu design in that game wasn't great. Like, the UI wasn't great, but it was very ambitious for what they were trying to do.
Just keep pumping out those Curse of the Moon games.
I want them to make another Ritual of the Night game, and I want them to nail it, because there's a lot of interesting ideas in that game that if they had a different art style and if they tightened it, it would be a great game, but that game is just not there.
I heard some criticism online that one of the great ironies of that game is that it's the spiritual successor to Symphony of the Night, which took the original Castlevania formula and like deconstructed it and added all this new stuff. And now people want them to create like a new Castlevania, but like not as close to the original as possible, but like trying to recapture that spirit, which is like the opposite of what Symphony of the Night did to Castlevania when it first came out. So like people were like, yeah, this is kind of a cursed idea to begin with, like to look backwards at a game that was revolutionary at its time and just create like a copy of it for the new age.
Right. Well, you know, Curse of the Moon was good, so at least we got that.
Yeah. It is what it is.
Yeah. So, where do we want to rank this game on our endless list? I should say that our endless list is available for you guys at home who are listening to this podcast to check out within the podcast description. It's up on our Medium page, and it is currently 95 games long. This is our 96th entry on the endless list. It currently goes from number one Super Mario 64 all the way down to number 95 Jurassic Park Trespasser. This game, for me, just to start our conversation, this game is a better game than Super Metroid.
Yeah.
Super Metroid.
If we're just starting with like people the two halves of the Metroidvania.
Super Metroid is a 10 for people listening at home.
Right. I think Super Metroid was a step to get to where this game is, but this game executes it better in like every regard, from gameplay to level design to sound to graphics to every aspect of it. They basically take what they are doing there and make it bigger and do it much better, in my opinion. Where do you guys think this game goes from there?
Well, I agree, starting at 10 with Super Metroid, for the purposes of this also being a best of the best, makes a lot of sense. I agree that I think it's better. I can't speak to Final Fantasy IV, but in terms of Shovel Knight, like, Shovel Knight has a lot of the great platforming and action that was probably somewhat inspired by games like Castlevania Symphony of Night and all the ones that came after it. Symphony of Night has more depth to me.
Right.
I love Halo, but this, I think this is a better game than Halo.
I think it holds up better.
Yeah. I think Halo held up fine, for the record. I think that this is just, this game has so much more depth, and the visual design of it and its place in like the canon of video game history, like, it, I think it's just, it clears the Halo barrier for me. Shadow of the Colossus, I can't speak to.
I think the it goes above Shadow of the Colossus because it's a it holds up better as a video game. I think it has more depth to it and more replayability than Shadow of the Colossus. I think there's just the fact that you can play this game like 10 times and have a different experience each time says a lot about this game. I think that the movement is so tight and responsive, and the combat is so tight and responsive, that is a very key contributor to why this game holds up over time. And I think all of that shines through and makes this a better game than Shadow of the Colossus, makes it a better game than Resident Evil, and even GoldenEye to me.
Yeah, Resident Evil is where I started to pause a little bit, and where I started to think about, because I think you guys played like the updated version of that for the pod, right? Like the, what, 2009 or 12 or whatever.
I have played the original before.
Right.
But I did play the updated version. Yeah. I think the updated version, the big difference for that is the map tells you if you miss something in a room, and that's like a big fucking deal with Resident Evil.
Right, and that got me thinking about, like, how do you talk about a game where you're kind of, the version that sticks in a lot of people's memory is the updated version, which it's now, you know, several years old, to, like, comparing apples to apples, Symphony of the Night to the original Resident Evil. Like, Symphony of the Night seems like the better game. It holds up better.
100%. I think it's a better game than the remake, to me.
Yeah, for me, I loved the remake. That's what I played. I haven't played the original. And, like, I had a blast with the remake. But, it, you know, it's a 3D horror game versus a 2D Metroidvania game. Both, I'm a huge fan of both. So I started to pause there. But I think this goes above Resident Evil, too. And I... Keeping that going, I think it goes above GoldenEye as well, because it's just, I don't know, it's got so much depth to it.
Chris, do you want to make an argument for why this game wouldn't go above Legend of Zelda, or do we put it above Legend of Zelda?
Yeah, no, I mean, we're kind of very much like in an area of our list where I think so much of this now kind of turns into like personal preferences. Like, all the games we're talking about are games with legacy and importance and influence and whatnot, and just kind of coming down to like, what, you know, what did I personally have the most fun playing? Actually, I have more fun with Shovel Knight than I do with this game. But once it gets past Shovel Knight, like all the other games, Halo, Shadow of the Colossus, Resident Evil, I think Symphony of the Night's better. GoldenEye, I have so much nostalgic fun memories that I don't really have with this game. But I guess being objective, it is better than GoldenEye. I don't know. I'm kind of stalling out somewhere around GoldenEye. And then Legend of Zelda, I think, is just... I just think that's such like a timeless, borderline, perfect game that it's... In my mind, it's hard to put this above Zelda.
I think that Zelda... yes, it is a... I think it's a very good game. I think it's a very important game. However, it is also extremely cryptic. Extremely cryptic. And I don't think it holds up well under scrutiny for somebody who doesn't have nostalgia for it. I think that the fact that you have to find a bush and burn it in order to progress in that game, it makes it worse in my mind than this game, to be blunt. I think that there are certain areas where your progression is locked behind you talking to a friend, getting a strategy guide, or having endless amounts of time, that makes this game better than Legend of Zelda. I also think that...
Yeah, I mean, that was like, but that was like the time that like Zelda was from, and that was a little bit more the norm, and, you know, it's really, it's not like, yes, Zelda the game is cryptic, but those secrets, quote-unquote secrets, are just so far out there in, you know, the gaming public knowledge that I don't know if that's so much a... really a fair criticism against it. I mean, I hear what you're saying. It is cryptic, you know, but you could also say with Symphony of the Night, there's so many items, power-ups, pickups you could easily miss in this game that aren't, you know, readily right. apparent.
But your progression isn't trapped behind those.
No, it's not. You know, I don't
it
know,
can,
it's,
it can it's, be yeah, at times. Like, you can miss the stuff to get to the inverted castle. Like, that's part of how that's
set up. That's true, yeah. But, if you don't get the glass, like, we were talking about the Richter ending. If you don't get the glasses and you kill Richter, that's the end of the game.
I'll agree with that. But, I just think that for a game, so let's put it out. So Castlevania Symphony of the Night came out 10 years after The Legend of Zelda. And Castlevania Symphony of the Night is now, what is it? 23 years old right now. And that game holds up so much better. It is just so comparable to modern games that I think it goes above it. And the modern games that it's comparable to, a lot of times don't do it as well. And I think that's crazy.
Yeah.
There's
it's like when those modern games do it well, they're doing it as well as Symphony of the Night, basically. Right. That's why it's working. And that's what I was going to say, and kind of the fun aspect. Like, I haven't played a ton of The Legend of Zelda, but I've played it before. Mechanically, Symphony of the Night is so much more fun to play to me, because you're doing this kind of fun, smooth, seamless platforming and fast combat and, like, exploration, and it's still in a 2D world, but it just feels... I mean, granted, it's 10 years of game development apart, but it's just... it's so much more of a joy for me to play than Zelda, which is like, oh, yeah, this is a very important game and not fun to play, but... I don't know. It's a faster paced and it's just more enjoyable to me.
For me, when I look at I've played a lot of Metroidvanias. So I played Axiom Verge. I've played Dead Cells. I've played Cave Story. I've played SteamWorld Dig 2. I've played like a lot of these games, and pretty much all of Rogue Legacy. I've played pretty much all of those games are not as good to me as Symphony of the Night. The only one that might come close to me is Dead Cells, but I still don't think it's as good. I think it's nearly as good.
I think Dead Cells perfects the combat, action combat of the Metroidvania genre.
Right.
In a way. But it's also a roguelike too. So like it's a different style of game.
Right.
It has depth, but not on the same kind of scale that Symphony of the Night does, which is like a complete finished package story, not like a game you start over and over again to do runs.
Right.
So I think like I'm outvoted on The Legend of Zelda. So I think that moves it up to against Metal Gear Solid.
That's where, to me, like, I could go either way, right? I could, if you wanted to put this at number two or put it at number three, I think these both are games that are excellent. They both hold up pretty well. The only thing I would say is that I think probably Symphony of the Night holds up a little bit better than Metal Gear Solid. But beyond that, like, one thing I'll say about Metal Gear Solid is that I think I enjoyed that story more, because say what you will about Kojima, but he's just, like, his batshit crazy stories are, like, just do it for me. Fucking
this
love
is,
it.
And this is early Kojima.
Right.
So it's like restrained batshit crazy.
Right. Yeah.
Very tight
yeah.
batshit crazy.
As somebody who I just got through Death Stranding, so I was like, and that game is like unrestrained Kojima to the fucking balls to the wall, and that game is probably interesting, probably not that great, but I still enjoyed the story.
It's funny how the differences and similarities between Metal Gear Solid and Symphony of the Night stack up when you look at them right next to each other, where it's like they both have this kind of like wacky game developer inside joke kind of spirit to them in both. But you get one at the tail end of the 2D era on the new 3D platforms, and then you have one that's like in the early stages of the 3D era, and it just nails it right off the bat too. Like, it's a few years in, but... you know, you're kind of like at this transition point over the 3 years or however much time passed, 1 year when they came out between each other.
Yeah.
So it's like the perfection of something that's ending, and then the perfection of something that's beginning in its early phases too, when you put them right next to each other between 2D and 3D games. So like, what's more impressive, a game that nails the 2D style of exploration that is like spawned a million Metroidvania games behind it, or like the cinematic stealth 3D action game that then also spawned a million 3D stealth action games behind it?
Right.
I think, well, to me, I mean, both these games are great. Metal Gear Solid, though, I think just for how batshit crazy it is, like, do the little things in that game where it's like having to like unplug your controller for a boss fight and your memory card getting scanned and like all the sort of like wacky shit that happens in Metal Gear Solid that like you're not going to find like in any other game. I was like, it, as someone who didn't play Metal Gear Solid until we played it last year for this podcast, or maybe even earlier this year, I was like, I've been missing out on something for a long, long time. And it's just, you know, I didn't get that with like Symphony of the Night, because maybe it is just because there are so many games in that style now that, you know, again, not better than Symphony of the Night, but kind of comparable, where it's like when I played Metal Gear Solid, I was like, you know, I haven't like played another game that does all these weird, quirky things so well. And plus, I thought the story was fun, and there's a Godzilla reference in one of the secret channels in the telecom. So, I mean, that right there for me keeps Metal Gear Solid solidly at number two for me.
So what? So when are we going to play Metal Gear Solid 2?
Oh, I can't wait. Let's relax the restraints on the crazy a little bit.
The anniversary is coming up. It's October 15th of last year. So
I'm so mad they just took Metal Gear Solid 2 off of Game Pass.
Really?
Yeah. To put a bow on this, I think I'm going to give the nod to Metal Gear Solid to stay at number two.
I agree. I think that it's a good waiting with Chris being hesitant with Zelda. We can put it at three. I think that's fine. I think two or three was where. What's that?
So that'll make Matt very happy.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot for this game. Well, we have a new number three game on our endless list. It is Castlevania Symphony of the Night. Congratulations to our 96th entry on the endless list as we march our way to 100 games on the endless list and our never-ending drive to add every game to our list. But thanks, guys, for joining us. You can find our list in the podcast description, the complete list. It's on our Medium page, the It's So Bad Medium page. You can also follow us at It's So Bad Pod on Twitter. itssobadpod@gmail.com is the email address for your questions, comments, concerns, recommendations. We always will accept recommendations. We will play every game that you recommend. We promise. It might take 10 years, but we're going to play every game. So, Chris, any final thoughts?
No.
Steve, any final thoughts?
I'm just glad we figured out what a man was thanks to this game.
Yes.
So good job, Alucard, for beating up your old dad.
He's sorry in the end, but aren't we all? So we'll see you next week with another episode. Do we want to do a big market tease for that one?
It's NBA Jam.
Yes, the game we are doing next week is NBA Jam.
That's Chris from way downtown.
Puts up a brick. All right. We'll see you guys next week. Thanks, Chris.
Goodbye.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Mike.